can you tell us a little bit about what life is like for you now? What are some of the things that you do with your time these days?
Actually, pretty much summarised there. Today I've been to the wards of Sir Charles Garden Hospital. I've had meetings with my research team. I've been to a Celebrate WA meeting, which is the Western Australia Day committee that chooses the West Australian of the Year. And last night I spoke at a school, Eden Hill Primary School, for the Fathering Project, and the previous night was at a cancer research thing. I mean, that's what we wanted to hear.
Yeah, okay.
Well, I'm not normally that busy. Actually, somebody asked me that I was that busy, but I reckon I look busier on paper. I mean, thanks for reading all that stuff out. I mean, I hate hearing it, but I just took a deep breath and braced myself. But I'm mostly at home having a glass of wine with my wife, actually. It makes me sound busier than I am. I think I'm good at getting good teams of people to do all the work, and I seem to get the credit, actually. That's basically how it works.
Fantastic. Sounds like a good setup. So you mentioned Celebrate WA. So part of what they do is the West Australian of the Year. And in 2013, you were West Australian of the Year. 2013-14, you were WA Australian of the Year. Was that for a particular part of your life or your work that you got nominated to be West Australian of the Year?
Pretty much, I think it was for the... Well, actually, for the West Australian of the Year, they focused on the Fathering Project. In fact, it was the Fathering Project that nominated me. I think for the WA Australian of the Year, it was more about the research and helping cancer victims and trying to cure cancer, etc. I think that's how it worked.
Okay, cool. Thank you. And I'm partly fascinated in your story because you are a WA man born and bred. So you grew up in, unlike myself, he's a more recent import. You grew up in Bassendean, a fairly working class area at that stage. What was life like for you growing up in Perth?
Actually, this is very topical because the school that I spoke at last night was actually my primary school. Working class. Well, most people were sort of working class when I grew up, which is, let's face it, a long time ago. Dad worked in a factory and a pretty traditional kind of working class family. We couldn't afford a car and a TV, and we just rode our bikes around and swam in the dirty Swan River down there in Bassendean and watched Swan Districts every weekend. And all my mates had, lots of characteristics. Most people were pretty poor, actually. We didn't think of we were poor, actually, to be honest, at the time. Most of the families were intact, and we just essentially ran feral. We just got up in the morning and ran feral, really, around the neighbourhood and swam and rode our bikes and mucked around and played cricket. And all our parents asked us was to be home at night. And as I think you mentioned earlier on, my family were not church-going family. But to be fair this sort of intellectual discussion, if you like, is we did all have religious education at school. No one had it. Well, I suppose you could have not done it, but I don't remember anyone not doing it. And most people went to Sunday school as well, so there's a fair bit of religious input, even though our parents were not churchgoers or anything.
Yeah, okay. But for you, the Christianity became more serious, or you decided to be a Christian while you were at university, is that right? While you were at medical school? Perhaps you can tell us a little bit of what led to that, why you made that choice.
Yeah, I mean, nothing's ever one thing in life, and I'd be lying, which I absolutely have no intention of doing to you tonight or any other time if I said it was a clean-cut kind of thing, but I think I was hardwired as a scientist. You know, I came out of the womb thinking about things. So even though I grew up in Bassendean, and you weren't allowed to be at the top of the class or anything when you grew up in Bassendean, you had to just, kick the ball through those white posts. That was the most important thing. But I used to climb up onto my parents' roof when I was a kid, and I used to sit on the roof and look at the stars, the universe, and try to work out the mathematics of the universe. And because in those days we were taught that the universe had been there forever, and it goes on forever, infinity in space and time. So this is kind of around 1960, and the Big Bang, which of course was discovered well before that, the news of that hadn't reached Bassendean. I told a friend that, and he said the only big bands in Bassendean were the sounds of the Stolen and Kingswoods. So I've always been kind of a thinker. So when I went to medical school, like I said, with some background, you know, sense of God, but, you know, by a tenuous threat would I have been said to be evil. Well, I used to laugh at, there was a guy, now he used to go to the Christian Union, I used to laugh at him. It seemed like a ridiculous thing to do, but I do remember that the complexity of the human body, it filled me with awe. This is when did I go to medical school? Like, let's just say 1969, the year of Apollo 11, the complexity of the body fascinated me. And here's the interesting thing, it still enthralls me. And, you know, we now work incredibly intensively with DNA and all sorts of things, and the complexity, the utter brilliance of the human body still fills me with awe. And therefore I felt like, you know, you're either in or out of this thing. And with great fear and trembling, I decided that I would give Christianity a go. And the fear and trembling was essentially about two things. One is my mates would all laugh at me. My mates in the footy club would all laugh at me. So I sort of shook my fist at God and said, you better not let me down on this. If you're there, you better not let me down, because I am taking a very humiliating step here.
Let's begin here.
See how gutless I was?
All right, and so that was at uni, and then when you finished medical school, you had taken a step with God for a few years, but had remaining questions. Or my understanding is that at the end of medical school, you did some travelling. You backpacked around Europe or around the world.
Yeah. Maybe you should stand up, because I just see you standing up and just worried that
people
can't see. Yeah, so maybe I've been a Christian for about 4 years, but one of the things that I realised was that, first of all, I was kind of disillusioned with the church behaviour, which is not an unusual reaction. You know, most of the time when people like Dawkins and Hitchens are talking about God, they're actually talking about religious behaviour. And I got a bit disillusioned with that. But also I was frightened of something, and that is the amount of dogma that I was taking in, you know, like those little chip birds in the bird's nest where mum or dad comes along and drops a worm into their mouth. And that's just not me. I'm far too much a scientist. And I thought, I cannot, all this stuff I've been told, you know, that we believe the dogma. So, and also medical school is a bit of a cloister, and, you know, Western Australia is a bit of a cloister, and Bassendean is a bit of a cloister. So I became very uneasy, and I thought I have to drop it all and travel. But not everyone has to do this, Paul, but I had to do it. So, you know, this sounds like bad, but I'm going to tell you the truth. I pushed over my faith, I pushed over everything. And I went backpacking, and I thought, this has to be authentic. This is a classic phrase from the hippie era, being authentic, you know. And I'm from that era, but
it's made a comeback.
You know, I guess I hate dogma. I hate dogma in science, and I hate dogma in atheism, I hate dogma in Christianity. I don't hate people really, per se, but I just hate it, you know. It just doesn't seem authentic. And, you know, it's not a search for the truth, but it's a tribal rallying around a flag. Anyway, I started reading all the God is Dead literature and backpacking, and spent 3 years really. And I think my faith and how I think about things is far more authentic now than it could possibly have been. You know, and maybe, Paul, maybe on that journey I might not have, if you like, become a Christian again, or whatever you want to describe it. Maybe I would have gone off on a tangent, but it didn't happen, so this is one thing.
And I understand that while you were travelling, you spent some time in Switzerland. So there's a writer called Francis Schaeffer who's bought a couple of his books to put on the bookstall. And there was a story behind how you got to end up in Le Abri in Switzerland, the school where he was one of the teachers. I'd like to hear the story from the horse's mouth, but also what was, how did that time in Le Abri, how long was it, how did it shape you, looking back on it, what made it significant?
You've done a bit of homework, haven't you, here? So when I was backpacking around Asia, I visited a few hospitals. I'm very interested in third world medicine. And I went for dinner at this couple's house, because you sort of had to eat dinner in the houses of the doctors, which are down there, maybe, because there's nowhere else to eat. Anyway, I told them my troubles, and they said that you need to go to this place called The Bree, which is not actually a school, it's some chalets, they're just houses. But it's set up by Francis Schaeffer, who believed that Christianity had a good, strong, rational basis, and people who were thinkers should come and discuss it openly. And they had a phrase: honest answers to honest questions. And I guess my experience had been that when I asked a question, it was sort of smacked down and I was told the dogma, which is what I've already alluded to. So, you know, I was backpacking around, and I still had, I tell you, in the pocket of my yellow backpack, which I still have because I can't get rid of it, the little mud map drawn by the wife of this couple in Thailand. She drew me this little mud map on a piece of paper. I still had it in my backpack. You know, so I ended up in that part of Switzerland and rocked up, stayed a few months, and kind of changed my life, because it's honest answers to honest questions. I mean, no question. In fact, they invited difficult questions. Please throw up difficult questions and let's work through them. And that is just beautiful for someone like me. And I found out then, I guess this is, the end result of that journey, that you don't have to be ashamed or worried about Christianity. Let me say it differently. As a scientist, etc., I think Christianity can stand resolute, and people need not cringe about science, medical science, archaeology, philosophy, psychology, etc. I've been strengthened in my view of that since then, but at the time, I mean, it was beautiful just to talk to people who had a good grasp of these things and who realised, you know, Christianity needs not apologise for these things. It stands very strong. It's not a perfect watertight argument. It just stands very strong. It is a reasonable position to hold. Not proven, according to faith, but it's a reasonable position. And that's really what helped me. And I'm very grateful to Dr. Schaeffer, who set this up really out of nothing. And I'm probably one of the sort of people he set it up for. Just the backpack that rocks up and in the right frame of mind. And he's a lovely guy too. He's just a wonderful man. I think this is probably part of the story. You know, you have to embody what you talk about. Otherwise you are not only inauthentic, but, you know, I'll stop there.
I think there's a word for it. So back in Australia, having trained at medical school, how did you then get into research? Not everyone who goes to medical school ends up doing laboratory research. How did that come about for you?
Yeah, I came back and I'd already had a few sort of qualifications from England and America and Australia. No, America, Australia. And I sort of got a bit bored with medicine. I'd done 8 years of it, and I don't want to sound like medicine is boring. I still love being a doctor, but it's not very challenging. So, I don't mean to be disrespectful, but when you look after your first patient with diabetic ketoacidosis, it's incredibly exciting. The sugars are up, the potassium's plummet, the fluids all over the place. But when you've treated your first 200, you just saunter in and, you know, squirt it all in and go home again, and you need to be challenged. So I thought I'd go and do some research to get it out of the way. Get it behind me. So I went to the United States, and within 3 months, I was hooked. And I tell the medical students this, because I really honestly thought I just wanted to be a good doctor. Hospital practice, private practice, you know. But this is the time when I knew I was hooked. I did. You had to learn how to do science. About 3 months in, I did this experiment, and it's about cells called killer cells, which protect against viruses in particular. And I had done the world's first experiment to see whether these things were present in the human lung and whether they work. And this, of course, is an important place for viruses, so pretty cool experiment. So I spent all day setting it up, and tubes were in the counter, and I went home and I sat there with my wife and our son, and I was crawling around on the sheepskin, very Australian in Washington. I said to Jackie, he went to bed, I said, right now, I know that my tubes are going through the counter, and tomorrow morning I'm going to know the answer to this question. I said, can't wait. So I got in the old Volkswagen, and down I went, 9 o'clock at night or so, and I stood there and watched as the counts came through, and I got the answer. It was a crystal clear answer, and I thought, there are 6.5 billion people in the world, and only one person knows this answer. And I reckon that golden book. But then I remember those days when I was a kid sitting on the roof and thinking about the universe, and I realised, where did I lose that curiosity? I used to build space rockets and telescopes too when I was a kid. And I realised that what it did was it rekindled a fundamental curiosity in me about how the world works. And of course, if you can apply that to medicine, I mean, what a wonderful thing if you can discover something that can help not just the patient in front of you, which is what a doctor does, but hundreds, if not thousands, if not millions of people. So, yeah, it kind of got me hooked. And now I do both, sort of 50-50, I guess, and I enjoy both.
And these days, do you get to watch the results come in, or it's more about working with teams of people?
Well, we've got 30 people up there at Charlie Gard this week. I don't do much in the lab now. And if I do, two things happen. One is they all sneak up and look over my shoulder and see if I can really do those experiments. But they say, look, we can do these, and you need to go and write the papers and the grants for us.
Yeah.
That's how you should spend your time. But no, I mean, I did about a year ago, it was about 6 p.m, and there was a knock on my office door, and in walked two scientists with the biggest smiles on their face. Because we've been trying to discover, this is a simple thing, that cancer is caused by mutations, and so logically those mutations should look a bit like a virus because they're foreign, the body's never seen them before. So why doesn't the immune system attack the cancer in the same way that it attacks a virus? It's a logical, obvious thing. Anyway, it's really hard to do this, and you've got a sequence of DNA, blah, blah, blah. It's like Human Genome Project, billions of bits of information. They walk in with a smile on their face and a piece of paper in their hand, and they discovered it. And you could just see this, the beaming smile on their face. And we very quickly got into not the world-leading position, but in a group of about four groups around the world that could do this. And so, sure, I don't stand there watching the machine now, but I get my kicks in a similar way.
And I was wanting us to spend a little bit of time thinking about the question of suffering, because it's such an important one. I guess you see suffering regularly in that you walk with patients who are diagnosed with terminal illness and walk with them to the point of their death. You teach medical students how to break bad news, and you haven't shied away from suffering in terms of, I understand that you spent time in Aceh, and when we were hearing about Aceh in the news, you had the opportunity and chose to go over there to help, and that what you've done is a long-term contribution in you've trained Indonesian doctors to care for the health of people in that area. I guess my question is, what's your experience of suffering and seeing people suffer, and what have you learnt from that experience?
Yeah, no, that's a good question and a very deep question. And I was asked a year or so ago to write something in the West Australian. I don't know if anyone's going to probably can read it. It's a 2-page spread in a Saturday paper about this. And I thought, they asked me to do this with death and dying. It's such a sort of morose subject. Anyway, the editor of the West asked me to do this. And I was pretty nervous, not writing it, but because they might edit it and it wouldn't come out right. Picked up a Saturday morning paper, 2 pages, not a single word was changed, because they realised that this is everyone's experience. Everyone over a certain age has suffered in some way. Parents, sick and dying, grandparents, partner, maybe, good friends. It's not suffering and grief is not far from anyone. And I've got to admit that when I was a young bloke, including in medical school, I was a bit of a jock, which means I used to play footy and all that suffering, I came out of it, snap out of it, school of psychology, just snap out of it and move on. So when people suffered and stuff, I honestly didn't have much empathy for them. It's terrible to admit. But then, when I went through trained and started, I'm a lung specialist, so the commonest lethal cancer is what? Lung cancer, right, so I got confused. I realised I didn't do it very well. I asked a few people, and I found that the students, well, no one's taught at that point. People weren't taught how to break bad news, so I thought I should learn myself, and then it turned out that I became responsible for the course. In the medical students, it's 25 years I've been running this course in the student. So let me just give an example of what we say to the students. And they've all got horror stories of patients or their parents or someone who they got told the bad news on the telephone or on a ward round when the doctor was talking to the nurse or something. And so we teach them how to make time, sit down with the patient to make sure there's a relative there if possible, hold their hand or have some sort of appropriate touch, make eye contact. We teach them that it's okay to cry if you feel as a doctor, you know, you feel a bit teary. I mean, I felt like that, particularly a bloke who's my age, who's got kids my age. I mean, I would weep. Not weep, but, you know, get all misty. And then how do you talk to them afterwards? I have to say, I have found that one of the most fulfilling parts of my medical career. Because I know that they don't get that. They get a lot more now, just from teaching students, but I'm not just me, but others. And then we have this sort of discussion. So let's say that you've got young kids, and you come back to see me, and I say, how's it going? And I sort of help you to talk through the kids. And then I have this discussion. I say, mate, I want to tell you something that every other patient has found helpful, but I'm not saying you have to. I'm just saying it's been helpful. So if it's okay, I'll tell you. And I say, mate, plan for the worst, but hope for the best. So I might have given you between 3 and 3 months and a year to live. So you think about the year and you say, well, that'll be great. And if you're a praying man, you'll pray, right, a miracle or that whatever, but you accept the fact that it could be a well done, good and faithful servant situation. But I say, mate, could be as short as 3. You've got to plan for that. Hope for the 12, plan for the 3. What does that mean? Writing letters to your kids so that they open them when they're 16, etc. I mean, this is deeply personal and poignant in a consultation. But it might be to go, whatever you like or whatever. It goes to a very dark place that no one wants to go to. The idea that they're not going to see their kids grow up, walking down the aisle, seeing them finish high school. And I go there with my patients, and they just find it so helpful. And, you know, I think you have to be pretty bold to do that. I mean, anyone who's been through that kind of journey. And in this newspaper article, I told the story, and I'll keep it short, but it was sort of one of those, I thought, embarrassing moments for me as a doctor, because I had a patient, she was about 50-something, and she had a big liver, and it turned out, she came to me with a cough, and she turned out she had terminal cancer, bowel cancer. I mean, I just found it incidental. You know, she came back to see me, and I said, how's it going? She said, I want to die. She sort of looked, but didn't ask if I could give her something. I said, oh, you're in that much pain? She said, no pain at all. But my husband's really angry because he's griefless, he's not managing the grief at this very well. He's shouting at my son all the time, and so my son's moved out to live with his girlfriend, who's very kind and sympathetic, so now he's living in sin as well. And my daughter, the hairdresser, she comes in, she doesn't live at home, but every night she comes and sits on the seat, and I make a cup of tea and dinner, and my husband thinks she should be cooking for me, but she doesn't even want to talk about the cancer. It's a living hell, and I want to die. But here's what happened. By an astonishing coincidence, I went to have my hair cut. The woman cutting my hair started to talk about something that made me think, I wonder if this is the girl. Couldn't wait. And I thought, in any case, there's all these people sitting around, you know, medicine, confidentiality. And I thought, hang on, she wants to die. I can't make it any worse. What's my moral obligation? So I said to her, can I ask you a question? I said, you're not related to Mrs. So-and-so, are you? She said, yes, I am. You're her doctor, aren't you? I realised immediately she knew all the time. She was too scared to ask because she is an avoider. She which is what most people are. So I got organised some family counselling and I went to see the lady in the hospice. She said, "I don't know what you said to my daughter, but he is miraculously changed." She said, "My husband's not angry anymore. We've all, the counsellors come around, we've all held hands and cried together. And my daughter, she comes into the hospice and does my hair every week." She said, "It's beautiful." I didn't actually do much, except I had the courage to ask about her daughter. Anyway, the point is, it's a very difficult place to go. And you do need training, but you've also got to have the courage to go there. And when you do, it just helps people enormously. So, yeah, I've seen a lot of suffering. I mean, I hear the kids crying out in the waiting room, as grandma's babysitting them, and I have to tell someone they're going to die. And I've walked the journey with them. I always see them all the way till they die, because I'm their kind of contact person. You get very bonded to someone when you break the bad news. The wife sitting there, the husband, whatever. But you asked about Archer. Yeah, I am trained in tropical medicine. And when the tsunami hit Aceh, I thought that was pretty sad. But then I was down south in my tent, and the death toll went from 2,000, 3,000, 5,000, got to 60,000, of course, it ended up at 250,000. But there was this ABC report about all these kids who'd become orphans. Because, of course, little kids could swim, but their parents and grandparents couldn't. And because they all live in one little section, kids just became orphans. There's so many of them. But then there's no grandparents around to look after them. Which, in fact, we couldn't recommend it. So I just wept. So I rang the state government hotline to volunteer. And no criticism of the state government. Anyone here ever seen Yes Minister or Yes Prime Minister? They had a junior Sir Humphrey on the phone doing the fullness of time with create a subgroup and a subcommittee to consider a white paper, a green paper, a white paper, to maybe in the future. Anyway, I ran Canberra to someone I knew, and he said, "You'll never go, mate. You will never go." Anyway, Brendan organised me to go actually up there with an Indonesian team. He told me I had to speak Indonesian because there's no spare seat on the translator, on a helicopter for a translator, and they're right at the coalface, so I just immediately learned to speak some Indonesian to get right. Pretty okay at languages, and just focused on that for a little while, and then went up there 5 times. Yeah, I mean, it is horrible, these places. You know, the houses are smashed to pieces for about a kilometre or 2 kilometres in from the ocean, and there's debris, there's kids' tricycles in the mud, and kettles and clothes hanging off trees, and just... and it's pretty emotionally hard work, but... And you just see, I mean, it's like there's a black cloud of suffering around the place. No one wants to talk. And you look at orphans, there's these two little kids who used to come to our hospital tent for what's called Sisa Sisa, which is so-called back neighbours, but of course we were making sure we had enough for the kids. And they were playing soccer, and the wave came in. So they swam and dodging the bits of wood, and some of the kids drowned, and some of them got spiked by the wood and shoot through the water. And of course, when the water receded and they climbed out of the trees and things, their parents were all dead, and they were living in a little console, which was a mini mosque over the road. And one of them had just this scary, frightened look in his eyes. I still think about him, you know, like his mate, who survived with him, was a bit more at peace, although he lost his mum from an illness, and it was just him and his dad and his sister trying to survive, and he lost his dad and his sister. I mean, it's just terribly tragic. The other kid just, I think, firmly scarred. Anyway, the point is, you go and show compassion. And I'll just make one other comment about this team. So I'll just make a comment about Christianity, because people struggle with how God can allow this to happen. A lot of the people who were there were Christians. Let me say that first of all. People say that's because they wanted to convert them. I didn't want to really show up out there to convert people. I said, no, you are absolutely forbidden in Aceh to do anything to do with Christianity. If you even mention it to someone, you and your team will be thrown out. Aceh is the most fundamentalistic Muslim province in the biggest Muslim democracy in the world. So that, they said, "Oh, you're only there because, you're Westerners, you got more money." I said, no, I was with an Indonesian team. So it turned out this Indonesian team were Christians. And I asked one of the people, so tell me why you're here. It's quite a poignant feeling to me because I'm watching all the time. And they are seriously at the coalface, sleeping in tents out in the bush. Most of the, like a lot of Westerners were in comfortable air conditioned places. They were right out in the tents out in the bush while I was out there living. You cannot mention Christianity, so why are you doing this? They said, well, we just thought we will show the love of Jesus, you know, because that's all we can do, so we're going to do it. And when everyone packed up and went home, honestly, a year later, they're still there doing the same thing. So I'm an impressionable person, and I'm impressed by people who live a life that reflects their philosophy. And it was very moving to see them. Now, Indonesian Christians, minority group, and I'm not saying there weren't other people helping, of course, it's just that it's, well, you ask me about it, it's just deeply impressive, you know, that people would get up in the morning. In one place, in a place called Lock Creek, which was really smashed. And we're sleeping in the tent, and next to us was the debris of a little mosque. And they just rebuilt the mosque for them, you know. No questions asked, we just rebuilt your mosque for them. It's a beautiful thing to see. You know, I said that.
You met my dad at church, you came to visit last year, and he's a scientist, but it's not his science that is the reason for his atheism, it's suffering. So he just can't believe, can't bring himself to believe that a good God would allow suffering in the world. You said a few things, but does suffering make it harder for you to be a Christian, seeing suffering?
It doesn't make it hard for me, to be honest, but I can appreciate and empathise with your dad, because I reckon, like, science is not an argument against Christianity, honestly, we don't think that, it's not right. But suffering remains the conundrum. And I've been asked often and pushed for some theological explanation for this, and there is one, but I tell you, I always refuse to give it, and I tell you why, because no one cares. They don't understand and they don't care, because when people suffer, it is a deep, visceral pain, and when they see someone who suffers, how can a good God allow? And the truth is, of course, here's the stupid thing about all this. God doesn't make it happen. Like in Aceh, the wave came in, of course, along the front. Along the front there were some bars, which is not good, and there were some brothels, and of course people said Allah. So I'm absolutely no disrespect to Islam when I say this, but Allah was punishing them by sending the wave in to smash them to bits. There's just not, you know, Christian understanding of God is that God doesn't author suffering, and he weeps with suffering. And that might sound, maybe, you know, sound weak and hopeless, but nevertheless, God weeps with those who suffer. And work that one out. I think it's difficult for people to deal with this paradox. The Christian view of suffering is, of course, to weep with those who weep and show love. As I just told you about Archer. And I told you about people who are dying of cancer. You weep with those who weep and you respond in love. It's a curious phenomenon, but I don't find suffering to be a knockdown argument for Christianity. Obviously, I wouldn't be here. And I have seen it in spades. I was also in Haiti after the earthquake, which also killed a quarter million people in Padana after the earthquake there. You know, it's just, I don't know, mate, it does not make it harder for me to be a Christian, but it is a curious paradox, and my response is always the same. To weep with those who weep and show love for those in need, and that's just what Christians are doing all around the world. I mean, Christians are disproportionately represented at the coalface of suffering, so it cannot be a knockdown argument. It's just that deep love for people. Even when you know, there's no chance of saying you're a Christian, it's not proselytizing, it's just deep love for people that comes as part of the package, if you like.
I guess your experience of walking with people, listening to people who are in the midst of suffering and who are facing their mortality has led to things in your life. It's led to the Fathering Project in some ways, hearing dads look back on their fathering. But it seems to have shaped your philosophy of what's good, or what makes for the good life in other ways. Can you tell us a little bit about what you see to be, from your experience and looking at other people, what you see to what makes the good life, and why fathering you reckon is part of it.
Let me answer them the other way around. Yeah, like a lot of things in my life happened sort of by accident. I mean, I always see myself as that little boy from Bassendean with his shorts and his t-shirt riding his bike around, and I'm always interested that anyone ever wants to give me an award or even bother listening to me. So I always think things are a bit of an accident. What happened was, like I said, I told you about dealing with men who are dying of lung cancer, and they start and saying, if they had their life all over again, I mean, what do you reckon? You take a bunch of 50-year-old men and you say, well, what would you do differently if you had your life all over again, apart from smoking? What do you think the thing they all say is? Wish I spent my time on the kids. But then one of them said something to me which actually got me to write a book. He said, I wish, like when I was young, I was like obsessed with work. Get ahead. Provide for the family, all those good things. But I didn't have anyone around to tell me that my kids needed me much more than I was aware of, and now it's too late. I wish I'd had it all over again. So I thought, I'll write a book, and maybe if one person reads it, I'll help someone. I got sort of became obsessed with writing this book in the next 3 months. Anyway, the book became a bestseller, so all of a sudden people thought I knew what I was talking about. I started to do some research. And I realised something really scary, that is that fathers are profoundly important, not just the icing on the cake, but profoundly important in terms of all the health issues, drugs and depression and crime and etc., etc. And dads have no idea what to do. Pretty much, their dad wasn't that good, they don't read books, they don't go to parenting seminars, and they're on their own out there in the suburbs. So we set up this project, and it's gone unbelievably well. And we are rolling this out across the country. We've been to 16,000 dads we've talked to. We've got a whole team of volunteers and a board and things. And the goal, and people say, isn't it great that you're working with dads? But we say, no, our target audience, our targets are not dads. Our targets are children. It's the future of our children and the enormous risks they face in life. And if you pick up a newspaper, any morning you'll see those risks articulated. We are interested in the future of our children. Just so happens dads are the most powerful missing force. So we are working with dads. And we're trying to just conquer our own market in WA. But New South Wales in the last 3 months have insisted we get over there. The Premier, the Governor, the Chief of the Commissioner of Police, everyone is... business people making us roll this out in New South Wales, and probably every state will have it in the next 5 years or something, or less than that. Yeah, and I think you've read something, Adelaide, you said the most powerful force to change the future of our kids. And so last night I didn't need to get in the car and drive all the way out for a 10-hour day to Bassendean and speak at Edenville School, but I'll tell you, it was so energising to talk to these dads. They love their kids, they just don't know what to do. And it was just fabulous. You know, some ladies there, some mums who talked about being daughters of dads, which, you know, there's a bunch of ladies here who will know what that's like. The powerful force of a father, for good or no good, and a daughter's sense of her worth, her beauty, her confidence, the way she can expect to be treated by a man, it impacts a girl for the whole of her life. And strongly impacts on their relationships, marriage, etc., capacity for intimacy. So, yeah, that's been really good. I've got a question.
I'll ask my next one. So, I haven't been to one of your fathering seminars yet. Can you give me the bottom line in 2 minutes? What are your top three tips for dads?
Well, I'll give you my, I can give it to you in 3 words. Read my books.
Nice plug. They're available on the bookstore.
I tell you, there's lots of ideas we have for people about how to spend time with kids, etc., and good tips on dad dates and stuff. But it all comes down to three things, which we call the bus strategy. Bus, as in Hay Street bus coming along. B stands for being there. kids need to know that you will always be there for them. You will always be there for them. And I remember hearing it. It was a suicide note at the hospital. Someone read out. This teenager said, "There's just no one on my side. Always tell your kids, I will always be there for you. Regardless, at 3 a.m, you pick up that phone, I will be there. I'll ask no questions, I will be there." U stands for unconditional love, which in a world of competitive academics and sport, one kid will be good at footy, the other one will be useless, one kid will be smart, the other one won't, and it's very hard for the one who's not good at sport, or not smart, or not pretty, or not well behaved, to realise that you love them. It's easy for them to think that your love is conditional on their performance. If only they were smarter. I mean, the kid next door is smarter. You just wish that kid, whose parents brag all over the place, you just wish that that child was yours so you could have the smart kid. I get this in medical school all the time. To show that your love is unconditional is really hard. S stands for feeling special. Each kid is special, but they don't feel like it. So to do things to help them realise how special they are, which are dad dates and dad trips and stuff, do that. P-U-S. But let me tell you just an example. Like, this is the summary of human psychology. But if, it's totally honest, all this stuff is all there in the Bible. So people have heard the story of the prodigal son, you know, wine, beer and prostitutes and where it comes, calling back his dad wants to let him pigsty, right? His dad sees him a long way. He knows his dad's going to be there for him, that's the beat. And he's got his speech already, so his dad runs out and throws his arms around him. He starts his speech, and the other night's first dot point, I've been a bad boy, second dot point, I'm going to work in the pigsty and pay you back. His dad cuts him off and says, "Oh mate, you're back. I love you, you know." Unconditional love. His love did not depend on his son working in the pigsty. And then anyone know that story? What happened? What did his dad do next? Throw a party. What's the one day of the year when you feel special? Birthday. B-U-S, I tell you, it's all there. You know, being there. I'll never leave you or forsake you. You know, unconditional love we call grace. I mean, it is all there. How do we ever miss this? That's what I remember. But it is at the core. And if you, and it's the same for mums, if you can make it clear to your kids that you will always be there for them, no matter what, and make it clear that your love does not depend on their performance, and make them feel special, not just tell them that you're so special, but do things that make them realise it, that you are willing to go out on a dad date or a mum date and have one-on-one time with them. Because if dad is busy and he goes out on a date with me, just me and dad, on a trip, I must be worth spending time with. To feel worthwhile is the biggest protection against becoming a drug addict. I don't need it, I feel worthwhile already. Thanks, I'll pass.
And the second half of the question, I guess, was a bit more broad about life. So if you hear dads looking back on, if I had my time again, this is the way I'd do it. What perspective have you got more broadly about what makes a good life from patients that you listen to?
Yeah, I do have a perspective on this because another thing about being a doctor is people come into my rooms to see me and they are essentially naked. So corporate leaders or famous people come into my office. And I don't care how much money they got, how much power they got, or how much fame. I honestly don't care. It's got nothing to do with the consultation. I'm interested in them as a human being. And pretty soon you realise that a lot of people live hollow lives. That's my best word for it. It's a hollow life. And I've got an analogy for this. They're like chocolate Easter eggs, you know, the chocolate's on the outside, but when you get on the inside, it's just fresh air. There's nothing in there. But I think of the answer to your question is a caramello life, where it looks the same sort of on the outside, but inside there's a rich golden core. So when I talk to these patients, usually they've got a bunch of things missing. One is they've got a partner and they don't have much of a relationship. They don't have a loving, nurturing, fun togetherness. It's just almost, they're like a fashion accessory. They don't have that relationship with their kids that we just talked about. They don't actually have many good friends and lots of acquaintances, but they haven't nurtured good, honest, caring friendships. You know, they don't look after themselves. They're pretty boring, actually. But no interests, fitness, etc. They don't have a community service. They, you know, they might chair some board or something, but they can't get out there and roll their sleeves up and serve people. So I think a Karamoa life or a good life has elements of all of those things, and you know, it doesn't come when you've got to work for it. Now, I'm lucky, like, thanks for reading that out, but I mean, it didn't even seem like me, because you know, I've got a much more balanced life. I mean, all this stuff I do, I just, you know, I think I have got a Karamoa life, and I'm so grateful for it. But you've got to work hard for it. That's what a good life is.
And before we go to questions, I was wanting to touch on the question of leadership. So you've got responsibilities leading teams, whether that's in research or in other things. What have you learned about leadership along the way? What are the couple of keys to leadership personally for you?
So you only wanted two, because I stoned you by saying read my books when you said three, didn't you?
Yeah, that's right.
I'm surprised you didn't say one. Leadership, right, so I have one of those roles, and I'm a bit of a slow learner, like most things. But maybe I'll tell you, there's three sorts of leaders, and I have not been so smart as to do the best one, up front. And maybe I'll give you an analogy of coaching football. I spent 6 years coaching the University Football Club, and I started with the leadership role number one, which is authority, the milky leader. Do as I say, because I am the coach. But pretty soon I realised something, that doesn't work. They all just look at their boots and say, we should finish. So then I went to the so-called charismatic leadership style, where you create a vision and you want people to say, hey guys, it's weird, be great, you know, the club, you know, all these years of tradition, it'd be great, and the bus, let's sing a song. And that works a whole lot better. But and it took me in 6 years of coaching, probably 5 years to work this out. So what works best is this thing called servant leadership. Servant leadership is where you lead, not from the front, but you make people believe that they did it. And as an example, in the grand final, let's say, Paul, you're sitting down, you're not playing well, hopefully, but I might come up and sit down next to you and say, mate, how's it going? You know, that guy, getting a few kicks, and say, yeah, what are you doing on? So, well, I'm moving to his right, his left foot rugged. So I thought I should move to his left. But I don't know, I say, yeah, that's a good idea, mate. And by the way, your vice captain, the guy's looking up to you, so I believe in him. Do that to 20 guys. And then have a little collective at the end. But here's the thing. One night, we were on a premiership, and one of the guys had a skin full of grog. He said to me, Bryce, mate, bro, we've got such a good team. He said, I love you, Bryce. I love you. You're a good coach, but mate, we're just done without you. And I'm not so. So I know about servant leadership, but I'm not so easily wounded that that did not wound me. But he doesn't realise that I've spoken to the other 19 guys the same way. 20 years later, we're at a 20-year reunion. I'm a bit late. It was at Left Bank at Creo. He walked out of the group and he put his finger on my chest and he said, "I'm onto you. I've been talking to these guys, and yeah, I thought I was the only guy that you did that to in the grand final. All the other guys said you did it to them as well." But servant leadership is you don't usually get that. Servant leadership is normally the Saturday night after the grand final. We could have done it without you. If we did it, you didn't do anything, you're not pulling your weight. You know, and again, just to be you know, I mean, I do think it's all there in the Bible, and I'm sorry to say this, but I mean, they asked Jesus, what's it like? What's the leadership? And when I'll be up there, and he said, I'll show you. He picked up a towel and a bowl and washed their feet. That's servant leadership. You want to be a leader, you have to do that. And honestly, I was pretty slow learning that. But there's the military leader, the charismatic leader, and the servant leader. And I'm not saying I'm perfect at the latter, you know, but I'm way better than I would have been. So in my work, just as in my footy coaching, I think I've learned that.
And 52 games straight for one of those teams in the footy coaching, is that right?
Yeah, so that was a record, 52 consecutive games undefeated, but I think it's been beaten since then.
Right.
I regret to say.
And one last question. So we've touched on a bit of your story and your beliefs along the years. Today, why are you still a Christian? you know, tomorrow it's a new day, a new set of decisions, new set of challenges. Why is it that you are a Christian now, still a Christian?
Yeah, that's a good question. My brother, Ian, he's way smarter than me, and he loves this question, because you say, why are you a Christian? Well, you know, I grew up in a Christian home, or you know, medical school, and was fascinated by the body. But the thing about Christianity is there's no fence. So in some religions, so I do a lot of work, obviously, in Indonesia. I go up a few times a year. And they say to me, in our culture, we don't believe that. You cannot leave the paddock. And again, no disrespect to anybody, but that's the way it is. You cannot leave the family. You cannot leave Islam or you will leave the family. But in Christianity, there's no fence. So you get up in the morning and do what you like. So my brother asked me that. What's that question? And I say, and I've got a summary of this. I say, because I'm a bit mad. Bit, B-I-T, stands is the first up. Because it's true. That is, because to me it's reasonably true. And this is where you've got to hand it to guys like Richard Dawkins. He says, you know, people say, why are you a Christian? Oh, it gives me meaning and all that sort of stuff. He says, yes, but is it true? And I admire him for that, because is it true is the first question. Now, you can believe in crystals and, you know, whatever magnetic field is affecting the way we, I don't know, whatever you want to believe, but, you know, it might make you feel better, but is it true? It's a good question, and I am a Christian, B-I-T, because it's true. But M-A-D is my observation, and you've touched on most of these, Paul. It makes a difference. It makes a massive difference, I think, in marriage. To live in grace with someone, to be able to live in grace and not keep a scoreboard and to care for the other person makes the difference. It makes a difference in parenting, a massive difference in parenting. How I've seen that with dads. It makes a difference in friendship, makes a difference in the workplace. Yeah, so I get up and I'm still a Christian because I think it's true and because it makes a difference. And not sure which one of the two is more important, but if it didn't make a difference, I might, you know, probably have dropped it back then and never picked it up. But it makes a difference to people's lives, and I've seen that. Certainly, to me, who's probably a bit driven and selfish and doesn't notice things. And like I said, when I was in medical school, I was from the snap out of it school of psychology. And, you know, I think my life is vastly different now as my heart's been softened and so on.